In the spring of 2026, a courtroom in Brazil began hearing the case of a young Argentine woman who had done something that, 90 years ago, the Brazilian state would have insisted was legally impossible. She had been charged with racism. The country that spent nearly a century insisting it did not have racism, that it had in fact invented a way to transcend it, was now putting a foreigner on trial for it. The case began the way so many of these cases begin, at a beach. Milagros Ferreira, a tourist from Argentina, made a series of comments directed at a Brazilian woman. The specific words are on record. They were the kind of words that carry a history. Brazil's prosecutors say they crossed a legal line. Ferreira's defense says something different. But the larger argument happening around the trial is not really about what she said. It is about what the country built in the space between what people were allowed to say and what they were allowed to do, and who was protected by that space for nearly 100 years. To understand why this trial matters and why it is impossible to separate from roughly 3.5 centuries of history, you have to go back to the plantation. Not as metaphor, as fact. Between the early 1500s and 1888, Brazil imported more enslaved Africans than any other country in the Western Hemisphere. The numbers are staggering when you sit with them. Historians estimate that somewhere between 4 and 5 million people were forcibly transported from the African continent to Brazilian soil, roughly 40% of the entire transatlantic slave trade. They arrived in the ports of Bahia and Rio de Janeiro, roughly 40% of the entire transatlantic slave trade. They arrived in the ports of Bahia and Rio de Janeiro, roughly 40% of the entire transatlantic slave trade. They arrived in the ports of Bahia and Rio de Janeiro, roughly 40% of the entire transatlantic slave trade. They arrived in the ports of Bahia and Rio de Janeiro, roughly 40% of the entire transatlantic slave trade. They arrived in the ports of Bahia and Rio de Janeiro, roughly 40% of the entire transatlantic slave trade. They arrived in the ports of Bahia and Rio. They worked the sugarcane fields of the Northeast, the coffee plantations of the Southeast, the gold and diamond mines of Minas Gerais. They built the colonial infrastructure, the roads, the churches, the great houses. They died in those places in numbers that were never fully counted. And then, on May 13, 1888, Brazil abolished slavery. It was the last country in the Western Hemisphere to do so. What happened in the years immediately following emancipation is a story that rarely appears in Brazilian school textbooks. With the formal institution gone, the ruling class needed a replacement framework, a way to maintain the racial and economic hierarchy without the explicit machinery of chattel slavery. What they chose was a policy called branqueamento, whitening. The theory behind branqueamento was precisely what it sounds like. Brazil's government, from the late 19th century into the early 20th, actively encouraged European immigration from Italy, from Portugal, from Germany, from Spain, with the explicit intention of changing the country's racial composition. The hope, stated plainly in the academic and political literature of the era, was that after 2 or 3 generations of intermarriage, the black and indigenous populations would be absorbed. The country would become, if not white, then close enough to white that race would no longer be a political inconvenience. This policy was funded, administered, and defended by the same political class that had just abolished slavery. The displacement of formerly enslaved people from economic opportunity was not incidental to branqueamento, it was structural. Jobs in the industrializing cities went preferentially to newly arrived European immigrants who had the full backing of government resettlement programs. Social services, when they existed at all, followed the same pattern. The people who had built the country were, after emancipation, systematically excluded from participating in its next chapter. Then came 1933 and Gilberto Freire. Freire was a sociologist from Recife, educated in the United States, who published a book called Casa Grande Senzala, translated in English as The Masters and the Slaves. The book was a sensation. It was beautifully written and intellectually ambitious, and it offered a reframing of Brazilian history that the country's elites were deeply relieved to receive. Freire's central argument was that the mixing of Portuguese colonizers, African enslaved people, and indigenous peoples had produced something new in Brazil, a hybrid civilization that had dissolved racial hierarchy through the very intimacy of colonial encounter. Brazil, he argued, had invented racial democracy. The book was wrong. Not in every observation, Freyer was a careful reader of daily life and material culture, but in its central moral claim, what he called racial democracy was, in practice, a system in which race determined economic access, educational opportunity, political representation, and physical safety. The intimacy Freyer celebrated was frequently the intimacy of coercion. Enslaved women had no legal standing to refuse the sexual attention of their enslavers. What Freyer described as fusion was often domination with better publicity. But racial democracy as a concept was politically useful. It was the kind of idea that powerful people reach for when they want to hold on to inequality while escaping accountability for it. The myth spread. It became official. It was taught in schools, repeated in newspapers, defended in diplomatic dispatches. Brazil positioned itself internationally as proof that the racial tensions tearing the United States and South Africa apart were problems of inferior political organization. Brazil had transcended race. Brazil had solved it. What the myth required was the suppression of evidence to the contrary. And the evidence existed. In 1931, 3 years before Freyer's book appeared, an organization called the Frente Negra Brasileira, the Black Brazilian Front, was founded in São Paulo. It was one of the most significant black political organizations in the country's history. At its peak, it had more than 100,000 members. It organized politically, economically, and culturally. It published a newspaper. It ran schools and social services. It advocated for the economic and civil interests of Afro-Brazilian citizens in a society that had spent 4 decades trying to make them invisible. The Frente Negra existed. It organized. It spoke. And then, in 1937, Getúlio Vargas declared a dictatorship and dissolved all political parties. The Frente Negra Brasileira was among the organizations dismantled. Its records, its publications, its political infrastructure, gone. The organization that had offered the most organized challenge to racial democracy ideology in its own era was erased precisely as that ideology was being consolidated. The mystery thread running through this history is not complicated. It is a question of institutional memory. What happened to the Frente Negra's archives? What was preserved and what was allowed to disappear? The colonial archives of Brazil's slave trade are fragmentary in ways that reflect choices, choices about what the national story was supposed to say and who was supposed to remain in it. The absence in the record is not neutral. Absences never are. The Cao Law arrived in 1989, named for the Congressman Carlos Alberto Cao de Oliveira. It made racism a crime in Brazil, not merely a civil wrong, but a criminal offense punishable by imprisonment. For the first time, the legal framework caught up to the political reality that the racial democracy myth had been obscuring for more than half a century. The law was passed a year after the new Brazilian constitution came into force. It was, in its own terms, a legal acknowledgement that the myth had been a myth, that racism had existed in Brazil all along, that it had harmed people, that those who practiced it could now be held to account. The law has been applied inconsistently. Brazil's legal system, like most legal systems, carries the marks of the hierarchy it was built inside. The prosecutions that have moved forward have tended to involve explicit, documented statements, the kind that leave a record, that are harder to explain away as misunderstanding. The structural inequalities that shape access to housing, employment, health care, and education remain largely untouched by the criminal law. They are harder to prosecute. They have more defenders, which brings us back to the beach, and to Milagros Ferreira, and to a courtroom in 2026. The case against Ferreira is specific. Words on the record. The Cao Law as the instrument. But the trial is being watched by people who are not particularly interested in the sentence. They are interested in whether a country that spent 90 years insisting racism did not exist can now hold someone accountable for it. And more importantly, whether the accountability extends beyond a tourist, whether it reaches the institutions, the policies, the books, the officials who maintained the myth while people suffered under it. Ferreira's defense has argued, as defenses in these cases often argue, that what happened was a misunderstanding, that tone and context were misread, that the application of criminal law to speech is an overcorrection. These are not frivolous arguments. They are the arguments that societies have with themselves whenever they try to use criminal law to address something the civil law and the political system have failed to fix for generations. What is less easily dismissed is the longer arc. The enslaved people who built Brazil's plantation economy were never compensated. The descendants of those people navigated a society that told them for nearly a century that the disadvantage they experienced was not racial. It was something else, something unmarked, something natural. The erasure of the Frente Negra was not an accident. The branquimento policy was not an accident. The racial democracy myth was not an accident. These were choices made by people with names, in institutions that still stand, in a country that is now, finally, putting someone on trial under a law that criminalizes what the myth spent decades insisting did not exist. There is a detail in this history that does not appear in the coverage of the Ferreira trial, but that sits underneath everything the trial means. When the Frente Negra Brasileira was dissolved in 1937, its records were not preserved by the state archives the way the records of other dissolved organizations were. Historians who have tried to reconstruct its membership rolls, its publications, its internal correspondence, have found significant gaps. Some documents survived in private collections, some were lost. Some may have been deliberately removed from the institutional memory of a country that had just decided it was going to tell a different story about itself. That is, the mystery thread, not the specific words Milagros Ferreira said on a beach. The mystery thread is whether the institutions that built the myth are capable of dismantling it, or whether the law is a gesture toward accountability that leaves the architecture standing. The question this trial cannot fully answer is the one underneath it. Whether a nation can write a law against a thing it spent a century systematically practicing, and whether writing that law is the same as confronting what it built, is not a legal question. It is a historical one. The courtroom in 2026 can determine what was said and whether it violated a statute. It cannot determine what it means for a country to have built an entire national mythology on the premise that racism was someone else's problem. Is it enough for a nation to criminalize what it spent a century refusing to name, or does real accountability require going back to the silence? Going back to the files that were not kept, the organization that was dissolved, the policy that was designed to make a race disappear into a better story. That is the question the trial cannot answer. That is the question that will still be there when the verdict comes in.